Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, cult classics, what they tell us about ourselves.
Whatever happened to Fay Wray, that delicate satin-draped frame.
If you haven't been to a midnight showing of Rocky Horror, you simply must put it at the top of your summer bucket list. Rocky Horror premiered in London in 1975, and it wasn't box office gold. It needed to age like a fine wine to become the cultiest of cult classics. Now it's the gold standard of what a great cult classic is. Over the top and excessive, cheesy and outside the mainstream, and opportunities for the audience to be involved.
Beyond any measure and sensual daydreams to treasure forever.
Today, a show about how our most cherished cult classic movies reflect on us, what they say about the culture, then and now. And that means you're going to have to call in with your favorites. Tell me about the cult classic that you can't get enough of, and tell me why. Tell me how it speaks to your own identity and your worldview. So I want to know about the cult classic that you love. Maybe you watch it once or twice a year, every year. And I'd like to know how it reflects your own identity and your worldview. Phone lines are open, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Paul Struthers is with us. He's the director of the exhibition of programming at Frameline International LGBTQ Film Festival in San Francisco. And he's with us from Oakland. And Paul, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, and good morning.
Good morning. Lily Percy is with us. She's a producer at On Being. She's a huge movie fan, and she's host of their podcast, This Movie Changed Me. I listen. I hope you will, too. Good to have you here.
How are you? Thanks, Carrie. I'm good.
I've been reading some rather varied definitions of what a cult classic is. I think I have to start, and even this morning as I'm talking about it in the newsroom, Nancy Yang said, oh, I love Goonies. I think of it. Really? That's a cult classic? I don't think of that as a cult classic, but for her it is. So how do you define it, Lily?
Well, that same situation I decided once I learned that we were going to be talking about this to figure out what is the definition of a cult classic. And there's obviously the standard, like, that seems to be one that community gets involved in, right, and gets behind. And so it's one where you can memorize the lines, and when you watch them communally, it's not really one you watch by yourself, it seems like. It has to be a communal experience that you have where you shout those lines back. You know every new scene that's going to come up. You can predict the music. Rocky Horror is a great example because those screenings that happen, people dance, they act out what's happening on screen.
They live the movie.
They live the movie. But, you know, like Nancy, I thought about The Sandlot. That's a movie that is not technically
a
cult classic.
She tweeted that. Yeah.
I mean, that's one where you're killing me, Smalls. You can quote, and I know so many people who quote it, but it doesn't have that midnight showing kind of status that Rocky Horror does.
So, Paul, is there a collective quality to a cult classic, and is there a code to a cult classic? Is that necessary?
I think when it comes to defining what a cult classic film is, it's very subjective, because I think a lot of people will say it's a film that when it was initially released, the reviews were poor. However, there was something the audience found in the film to enjoy, and slowly over time, it became a cult classic. Well, at the same time, I view personally a cult classic a film that it might not be the best made film, but it's a film, mainly in my younger years, I could have watched four times in a day, like a film such as The Breakfast Club, etc. So I think that cult classic, the meaning can be vague for everyone, I think, yeah.
So, Paul, I think you said at the beginning of that it often doesn't get good reviews. I mean, is that one of the necessities of a cult classic? People didn't realize how genius it was at the beginning?
I don't know necessarily if it was people didn't realize it was so genius, but I think it's more people didn't realize the effect it would have on audiences. There's that film, The Room, which has been playing in cinemas for years and years and years, and when that came out, there was nothing about it, but probably played as much as Rocky Horror Picture Show around the world, if not more. And I think it's what you were both saying earlier, it's about the audience interaction with the film, because I've been to screenings of that film and people bring spoons or they give you spoons and you throw spoons at the screen. I think there's some sort of interaction. I think it can be varied, a cult classic. Yeah.
So we have a clip of The Room. I've never seen this movie. So
you're missing out. You have to see it. And you do have to see it with an audience. I mean, I'd say see it once by yourself, then see it with an audience. An entirely different experience.
Okay, here's a clip of The Room.
I can't talk right now.
Why, Lisa, please talk to me, please. You're part of my life. You are everything. I could not go on without you, Lisa.
You're scaring me.
You are lying. I never hit you. You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
You should have seen Lily the minute she heard the first word. Okay, is it silly because it's such bad acting? Is it silly because you know the context of it?
What? All of it. All of it. And because a lot of times, I mean, he literally doesn't make sense. Like, the scenes don't make sense. There's so many reasons why this movie is amazing. But one of them really is the fact that you just laugh all the time. You can't stop laughing.
At them, not with them?
I'd say probably a little bit of both. I mean, if you're more of a hopeful person, you see his intention. He clearly really wanted to make a blockbuster. In his mind, he is Marlon Brando. What comes across the screen is not that at all.
You know, Paul, when I was thinking about this, I wondered, is there this quality of we're laughing? Yeah, there's some jokes in the movie, but we are also laughing at you because you don't realize how stupid this is, and it takes an audience to get that. Is that a component of a cult classic?
I think it can be. And I suppose another thing people talk about cult classics is it's so bad that it becomes good. Mm. You know, and I think that's the case with The Room. People at first, when it first came out, oh my God. Then I think, from what I recall, a lot of younger people, perhaps students, got a hold of it and really took it as their own and owned the film. So I think they just celebrate it. And it's just good to have a variety of films. Not all films have to be super serious or about important issues. And I think that's why society has really latched onto that film and why a lot of the cult classics tend to be comedy, even if they don't make it a minute to be funny.
That makes sense. Hey, we have a bunch of calls. So on Twitter, Dylan says, The Big Lebowski.
I was just thinking of that.
Yeah.
Because it was critically panned when it came out.
Yeah.
And yet
for
it became
reason.
This iconic. Oh, I disagree, Carrie. What?
No.
The Dude Abides?
This would be a good time to take some calls, I think, to Paul in St. Paul. What's the cult classic for you, Paul?
Harold and Maude.
Why?
Right. And I'm not sure it falls in the definition you're talking about. I've never watched it with somebody, but as a young kid in high school and stuff, it just kind of broke a lot of the barriers for me. Of course, it was the classic rich kid who falls in love with a really adorable, much older woman, and I love the relationship between the kid and his mom. Like, of course, the famous scene where she gives him a Jaguar, and he immediately converts it into a hearse. And he just broke all the barriers, and the way that he loved Maude was just something new to me, you know, kind of growing up in a middle-class family
really?
In the neighborhood.
Does Harold and Maude make your list?
Oh, definitely.
Really?
I had never seen an example of intergenerational relationship like that. That's what they were modeling. I mean, she's like 60 years older than him, maybe. It's a fascinating love story in the fact that it's not sexual, it's not romantic, but it's still love. And they were modeling that for us. And there actually has never been a movie like that again.
Paul, I want to read you something that I read out of The Guardian of London on what a cult classic is, and a real flexible kind of definition here. But I found this interesting. This writer says, cultists do not really want to share. They want to make noise without really being heard. He says that cultists, you relish their outsider status, and that this collectivity we're talking about is not something that they really appreciate. What do you think?
I think that's fascinating. I think that is makes sense for the more sort of underground cult film that isn't like Rocky Horror Picture Show, that isn't like The Room. Films that have small appeal and films for the real left field cineasts, because there's a real underground, especially of horror cinema, comedy, camp horror, that the general public just don't know about, and they like to keep it to themselves. So I think that's a great definition for the more sort of left field art house underground films. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Does that make sense to you, Lily?
It does. It does. It's an interesting thing to think about, though, if like a filmmaker sets out to make a cult film.
Right.
I don't think I've ever thought of it that way. I've thought of it always in the definition of it then happens to become a cult film, but their intention was that as many people as possible would see it. But it's fascinating to think maybe their intention was that it would always have that kind of status.
And does it add to the quality of the cult film or take away from it if the director sets out to create the
Is it more manipulative?
Cult classic? Yeah.
That's a great question. I don't have an answer to that.
I think ultimately most directors do want their film to be cult because cult means so many things, you know. It means that it's popular, essentially, and everyone wants their film to be popular, like a film like Kevin Smith's Clerks, which was a really cheaply made black and white film that many would say is the start of like American indie cinema. Who knows? I don't think he set out to be a cult film, but it became a cult film, you know?
But Paul, I mean, I thought most directors would want, if not blockbuster, you know, lots of ticket revenue and a lot of people seeing it. I mean, when I think of cult, I think it takes a long time. It's a slow build, right? Most directors, that'll put you off getting work for the next few years, won't it, if you're not bringing in ticket sales?
Yeah, but I just think some cult films can be really successful. For example, there's a film set in Oakland at the moment called Sorry to Bother You. It played at Sundance. It's been getting great reviews. It's doing well at the box office. And I would still classify that as a cult film just because of the subject matter and the form. It's doing something different. It takes you off on a wild tangent in the last third. And I think it's successful, but it's going to be a cult film in the future for sure, you know?
Marcus says on Twitter, Showgirls with Saved by the Bell, Elizabeth Berkley.
Yes, that's a great one.
The costumes, extravaganza, the lifestyle of Las Vegas, also the dark side of trying to make it in the world and how far someone is willing to go to make it. To Zach in Minneapolis. Hey, Zach, hi. What's your cult film?
Hey, it's not one that probably most people would even consider, but Nacho Libre has always stood out to me as the greatest movie of all time. And I think cult films are so good at creating an experience for the watcher that it's a stupid plot, it's stupid acting, but it creates this memorable experience that even a decade later you can remember really specific quotes. Hey, take it easy. Leg on my blouse. All these things from these movies that really create this experience for movie watchers.
Has he persuaded you, Lily? You're kind of going,
I honestly, I've seen this movie, but I can't remember it. Oh. So that to me says a lot.
Okay, right. Hey, if you've just tuned in, we're talking about cult movies, your favorites, why. We've also talked about the definition of cult movies. Maybe you want to join in on that. Lily Percy with us. She's a big movie fan and with us from, and a producer at On Being. And Paul Struthers with us from the Frameline International LGBTQ Film Festival. I'm asking you to think about how our favorite cult classics reflect, in a way, our own worldviews and identity. Have you ever put the two together? Do you just love a movie? Have you really ever really thought about what it says about you and about us? 651-227-6000-800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Okay, throw another movie into the mix here. We might just have a clip that you consider to be the cult classic.
Well, I started to think about the two that I go to.
Okay.
One is Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And that one is John Cameron Mitchell directed it, and it was based on an off-Broadway production he did and actually brought it to Broadway with Neil Patrick Harris in the role. And the music, because a lot like Rocky Horror, it's about the music. It's a rock opera, but it's also about this woman who is coming to terms with identity and being an outsider and what it means to be man, woman. It's gender bending. I mean, it has a lot of the same kind of principles of Rocky Horror, but to me, it's just the music takes it out of the park. And then Trainspotting. Trainspotting is a movie that I was trying to figure out if it is technically a cult film, but it feels like it for me. They're quotable lines. I mean, I've seen it with an audience and a midnight showing, and people know the lines. They yell them out. They know the music cues that are going to come up. But it is also an independent film. It's an art house film. So it blurs those lines.
Trainspotting for you, Paul? Do you buy that?
Well, Trainspotting is funny you bring up because I'm from Scotland.
I know. I was going to say your accent. Yeah.
I like that you bring up Trainspotting because that highlights what I was saying earlier. Like, a cult film, it can be so loose. That's why I would classify Sorry to Bother You as a cult film and why it's fascinating you bring up Trainspotting as a cult film, because it doesn't really fit the sort of objective definition of what we think a cult film to be, but it is at the same time, you know, because it does feature great music, has great lines, there's fantastical scenery in it, and it's a great film as well. It got universally great reviews all round. So it's just so interesting to talk about what is a cult film, because it's just so varied, isn't it?
Yeah. A call here from Mike in Minneapolis. Hi, Mike. You have a couple cult favorites, and why? Tell me.
A couple cult favorites kind of symbolizing us kind of in the millennial and pre-millennial gap.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a before and after.
Mm-hmm.
The first is Hackers.
On the
pretext of the tech bubble, there were a lot of LAN parties going on. Rave culture was quite big at the time, and this was just a completely over the top view into those two subcultures as they were fully emerging. On the other side of the tech bubble, the other one of quite a lot of significance for many people was actually Donnie Darko. As the bubble burst, as immediately after 9/11 occurred, that seemed to represent more of the hangover from the tech bubble itself and a dramatic shift in culture for people in their early to mid-30s at the time. And I don't know if I can go through my Rolodex and speak to anyone who can't begin to quote both those movies front to back.
Hey, really good description there, Mike, of Donnie Darko. I've seen that a couple times. And you're right, it speaks to the moment, and it gives us a sense of cultural history. I guess that's required too, right, for a cult movie, that it tells you something maybe you didn't know when you were living through that culture.
Yeah, that's really true.
And I think, and also thinking about it more, I think a cult film is a film that requires repeat viewings, whether it's something like Donnie Darko because you're trying to work out the plot, or whether it is because the music is so fun and you want to sing along. And you're talking about cultural significance. One of my favorite cult films from the late 80s is Paris is Burning, the seminal queer documentary about the Vogue subculture in New York then. And that film is one of the biggest queer cult classics because it was one of the first times that that world had been shown on film. And it was just so authentic and gave hope to people of color all over the world, and that film still influences people all over the world. I saw an article the other day, I believe, on Huffington Post about someone in Lebanon who'd seen the film and had started voguing there. You know, it's just
amazing.
Michelin says on Twitter, Super Troopers, Anchorman, and Dodgeball. Courtney says, oh, I love this movie, Waiting for Guffman. Is that a cult movie? I love that movie. I would like to think that. There are lines that people can say
back. There are lines that people are quoting,
But you hesitate on whether that
I do.
She says, unscripted, hilarious, genius. Okay, we have a clip of Dazed and Confused. Jessica is saying, Dazed and Confused, all right, all right, all right. What do you like about this movie? Does this match your cult classic standard?
You know, it's one of my favorite movies actually of all time, so I
don't
even know if I'd list it. I do. It captures a moment, but it also captures a moment in youth that is eternal. You know, it's set in the 70s on this last day of school, and Alice Cooper's School's Out is playing. It's so iconic, the soundtrack. But I watched it, you know, as a kid growing up in the 90s, and my high school experience was very different from the 70s, but it wasn't. And that's the thing about that movie. It's got that amazing specificity to the time and what they were going through, but it's also so universal because we all are dealing with hormones and girls and boys and drugs and rock and roll. So it's perfect.
Hey, that'll be another show to have you come in and talk about your high school there. All right, here's a clip of Dazed and Confused.
Say, man, you got a joint?
No, not on me, man.
It'd be a lot cooler if you did.
Oh, Matthew McConaughey. You can't get better than him.
That's right. I mean, does he know how campy and goofy he is?
Well, I actually produced an interview with him where we talked about that because this was his breakthrough film.
Oh, I didn't realize
that. And he was channeling his older brother, who he thought was the coolest guy ever, down to the way he talked, the way that he drove, the way that he just like walked. And so it's very much like a kind of a tribute to his older brother, who was just the player that he grew up admiring.
Paul, do you like that movie? Does it?
I love it. Like growing up in Scotland, or if you can say the UK, we would always emulate Americans. We always wanted to have a locker because we didn't have lockers at school. That's a film that me and my friends from the age of like 15 until we went to university watched repeatedly. We just loved it, the initiations, the music, everything about it. It's a perfect example of a cult classic. I just read the Parker Posey autobiography, and she talks a lot about Dazed and Confused.
What it was like making the movie?
Yeah,
you should check out that book because she's actually, that's another interesting thing to talk about, cult stars, because I would say she is a cult star because a lot of her films have become cult classics like Dazed and Confused, you know?
And is the reason, I think of her as kind of the queen of the indies. I mean, do you think when you hire an actor like that who kind of has that reputation and you put them in a movie that you hope becomes a cult classic, I mean, you're kind of stacking the dice there. Are there some actors who just could never be in a cult classic?
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, could Tom Cruise be in a cult classic, you guys?
That's so funny you say him because I think, because he was in Magnolia.
That's
which
true.
Is a cult classic. You know, I think anyone can be in a cult classic, but he was playing against type.
Right.
They say superstars play themselves, actors play characters.
Yeah.
You actually played a character for once, you know?
But that's so fascinating, Paul, because for me, Magnolia is an independent film, whereas I think Top Gun is actually a cult film. I think about how you can quote that movie.
It's cheesy.
It's cheesy. Yeah. Oh my God, the Iceman, I feel the need for speed. I mean, those are the kinds of community building experiences you have.
That's right. Lance says, our film is the Burbs, quote, take me to the hospital. I've been blown up.
Love and the Burbs.
To John in Minneapolis. Hi, John. Thanks for waiting. What's your cult classic?
Troll 2, for many reasons. It was a sequel to Troll, and there were no trolls in the sequel. They were actually goblins. And it was an Italian director who was trying to get across an allegory, but it was completely missed. And there were so many memorable lines in the movie. There was actually a documentary about it called The Worst Movie Ever Made. And I encourage anyone to go watch it. It's beautiful.
Wait, the movie about the worst movie ever made is beautiful. Okay.
Oh, yes.
But
because you get a better understanding of it. You get why the director was doing what he was doing. And
I love the idea that there are no trolls.
You know, why not?
In Trolls. But you know what else, John? You're reinforcing this idea that the audience is in on the inside laugh, kind of, right?
Mm.
From the beginning. Like, this is what I meant about code. You've broken the code, John, right from the beginning. Did you feel like that?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I loved cult films for a long time, and it's you know, like it's up there with The Room almost with the absurdity and just but with this it was actually intentionally made, unlike The Room, and there was a depth to it that was missed initially, and that's why I think it's actually a brilliant movie.
Okay. Have either of you seen Troll 2?
No, but I'm going to see it tonight. I have to see it now.
How about you, Paul? Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it, sadly, but I will add it to my long list of films to watch.
And you know what's great about this? You can see Troll 2, and then you can see the movie about the making
exactly.
of Troll 2.
Exactly. You have to
Your
follow
weekend
it up.
Is set, Lily. Jeez, I was going to invite
Day
you
Labor Day plans.
Out. I had cocktails on my mind, but you'll be busy watching this. To Jesse in Grand Rapids. Hey, Jesse, hi.
Hey,
hi.
I have a go-to when I just don't know what I'm going to watch. And my brother got this. He was working at a video store years ago, but it's Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. She came out with this, you know, she did a bunch of those kind of campy, almost like mystery science theater 3000 things where she would be the hostess of these really bad, campy films. But then they made a full-length feature film, and it is just, oh, so hilarious. Bad jokes left and right, and you know, monsters. It's got Edie McClurg, who was the you know, the secretary from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I mean, it's just perfect.
How does it hold up, Jesse? You know, like when you watch it this year or last year, is it still hold?
Oh, yes. I mean, because it was campy and bad when it came out, and there's kind of full acknowledgement of how kind of silly and over the top it is. I mean, that was kind of her shtick. So yeah, I mean, it's, of course, it's dated. It was made in the, I think, the mid or late 80s, but it's just as good and just as bad as it ever was.
You also said the magic words, Jesse, which are mystery science through that. Yeah. Lily knows what I'm talking about. A show made right here in Minnesota. My husband used to watch it when we lived somewhere else. You didn't know it was made in Minnesota?
No, another thing that's made in Minnesota.
Oh,
Minnesota.
God, right? See, look, what if you'd this. Left Minnesota and you didn't know this incredibly important fact about Minnesota?
Far worse off, yes.
What do you think the influence of mystery science is on the way we see cult classics?
That's a great question, because it kind of introduced us to the idea of getting together and just quoting and
yelling back at the screen.
Doing commentary. I mean, it was like our own DVD commentary of these movies.
That's right. I don't know. Paul, what do you think? Do you know what mystery science is?
I don't. I only moved to America a few months ago, so I don't. I know the film Weird Science.
Weird Science, which is also a great cult film.
Paul, you have to look this up and watch these weird creatures in silhouette against the
robot.
Big screen.
Uh-huh.
One's got like tools coming out of his head.
Yep.
They've got a new one that they're making.
They do.
Right?
That's what I've heard. Yeah. And what they would do, Paul, is that they would get together and watch often movies like B movies, movies from like the 50s and 60s, a lot of horror films, and they would just comment and make funny commentary on it.
I mean, really dry.
Yes. Witty stuff. And it
really
was just
good.
So much fun to watch.
Now we know what Paul's doing all weekend. Paul, I hope you had no other plans, right?
Yeah.
It's a conversation this hour, if you've just gotten in and out, about cult classics, what they tell us about ourselves, what they tell us about, you know, us as individuals, right? And that experience of coming together collectively to watch a cult classic, why that's so cathartic. I want to hear about your favorite cult classic and what it says about you. And then maybe we've got a few more clips here of some cult classics, so we'll play that as well. 651-227-6000 on Twitter, at @CarrieMPR, where Jenny says, I can still quote every line of Clue. Now my daughters can, too. Are you passing along the cult classic in the family? Paul, Lily has a question for you. Yeah.
It's a very, very deep question,
Paul. All
right,
good.
I have interviewed a couple of different Irish actors over the years, and I've been told that Dirty Dancing and Clueless are two movies that literally play on the TV in Ireland all the time. And I wondered if growing up in Scotland, it was similar for you. If Dirty Dancing and Clueless were movies that were kind of cult films?
Yeah, both for sure, 100%. People love Dirty Dancing in Scotland. I think it plays every Christmas. I haven't lived in Scotland since I was like 19 and I'm 37 now. But from memory, yes. And yeah, Clueless did play on the TV a lot, and that's a good example of a cult classic because it just had great lines in it, you know?
It did, yeah.
Also, another thing about a cult classic is often the actors don't do anything that big again, and a lot of the actors from that are quite infamous now because they haven't done much again apart from maybe spoken out about different things, you know?
Oh, yeah. Paul, you said that often so they don't have long or storied acting careers.
They're known
often
for those films.
Oh.
Yeah. If you think about Clueless, I mean, Alicia Silverstone, that was her film.
Yeah.
I mean, she's done other things, but that was Cher in that movie.
I think she's got a new TV series,
doesn't she?
I thought I was reading about that. Mia says, how about Austin Powers? I think my family watched that movie over 30 times and to this day repeat the lines. And another listener here says, one thing to consider when talking about cult film is the way in which viewing becomes an initiation rite, especially among more serious cult classics and underground and subversive communities. Wow. Mm. Films like Videodrome, Fight Club, and Holy Mountain. Fight Club has popped up a couple times on the list. Paul, do you consider that to be a cult classic? And what do you think about this initiation rite part of this?
I think it's an interesting discussion around cult classics. And I think it highlights that often a cult classic looks at a subculture. Like, we hadn't seen a film about fight clubs before, and it did feel a bit like an initiation when you were watching it. I suppose with Fight Club, the reviews were like 5 stars across the board, which doesn't really happen for a lot of cult films. However, I think it does have cult status 100%, that film. Yeah.
Call here from Rebecca in Amory. Hey, Rebecca, hi.
Hi there.
Hi. What's your favorite cult classic? You know, we've had so many men calling. I'm really glad to hear some women are out there watching cult classics. Way to go.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I'm going to need you to put Office Space on your list.
I was thinking that. You are so right.
What do you love about it, Rebecca?
I love the inner eye roll that everyone experiences at work.
I know.
And I think we've all had the experience of having maybe kind of annoying but endearing coworkers. We spend so much time at work together.
Yeah.
And then there's so many lines to quote from that movie. And it is kind of the worker bee subculture that sort of comes out when you watch that movie, that it's just kind of you live vicariously through it.
Universal experience. I mean, Lily, you were saying, was Office Space on your list too?
Oh, definitely. And I think in the same way that I believe John, the caller previously, was talking about movies that, like, hackers predict what's the moment, but what's going to come. I think Office Space was also of its time. It was predicting a future where we would all be pretty miserable sitting in cubicles and having to deal with paperwork that we just question as to why is this important. TPS reports. Why do we have to do these reports? That movie was so ahead of its time. And when you watch it today, you will relate to it. At least I definitely do.
Call from Peggy in St. Cloud. Hi, Peggy. Hey, Peggy, are you there or did we miss you? Uh-oh, I think we did. To John in Burnsville. Hi, John. Are we having some phone problems here? Hey, John, hi.
Hey there.
Hi.
Hello.
What's your cult classic that you love?
Well, I thought that, I had a whole list of them in hand, but if I knocked it down to one, I think I would choose Kinky Boots.
Oh,
that's a great
one. Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Paul, what do you think? I'm sorry, John, go right ahead. Tell me what you love about it.
It is, above all, very realistic about what it's like to be someone who is different in a somewhat conservative society and in ways that it affects economics.
Huh.
Part of the theme of that movie was where Charlie, who is running a boot factory, second generation or third or fourth, is having a very difficult time financially, and the main character comes and presents him with a proposal for making very sexy kinky boots.
Yes, I love it.
You know, and of course, you obviously one of the quotable parts in there is you're not selling. I can't remember exactly what it was, but you're not selling boots. You're selling 3.5 feet of pure sex.
Paul, what does Kinky Boots make your list? I love that movie. It's great.
Yeah, 100%. It's just the story in itself, Kinky Boots, it's a cult classic already, you know? And audiences just love that film. I think that's a great addition to the cult classic list, for sure. It makes me want to watch it again. I haven't seen it in a while, actually.
Same.
Hey, I'm seeing Damon here. Caddyshack is popping up a lot. Someone says, hope you mentioned Caddyshack. It's the only reason I still golf. Swingers. Planes, Trains, Automobiles. Oh, that's a class. That's
I love John Candy, so anything he's in.
He seems to me, now he had a career, a short career.
Short-lived, because he died fairly young.
Right, outside of cult classics, but he also seems to me like the consummate cult classic actor.
I agree. I mean, Uncle Buck is a movie that is on my list of cult films, and the folks who've seen it can quote it. They know automatically the epic scene where he throws a quarter at the principal and he tells her to gnaw that thing off her face. Go downtown, get a rat to gnaw a wart off her face. But it was also John Hughes. It was tied a lot to John Hughes in those days because Uncle Buck was John Hughes, and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was not, I believe, but they were all tied in that 80s just fantastic comedy writing as well. So it's blurring that line again between comedy and just what makes it a cult classic.
Yeah, right. Okay, we have a cult classic scene here. I'm not going to tell you. Let's test yours and Paul's true knowledge of a cult classic.
Here we go.
Yeah, it's the next one, guys, in the control room on the list. Let's just play it and see if these guys know it. Silence. Do you know that? They can't find it.
The Scorsese movie. It could be a cult film eventually.
Very happy because I've stumped the movie queen.
You've
here.
Stumped me, yeah. I don't know about Paul.
You don't know this.
No, okay. At all.
Paul, you know what it is?
I don't know if it is either, no.
It's from Eraserhead.
Oh, there you go.
Uh-huh. Now does it make sense?
Yes, but I've only seen that movie once, and I also have thoughts on David Lynch, so
okay,
plenty of thoughts
him.
And feelings.
Here, let's hear your thoughts on David Lynch.
Actually, I think he might qualify as a director who, as Paul said,
sets out
to make the cult film, which is why I find it to be manipulative often. And that's one of my problems with David Lynch. I love The Straight Story, and I think it's because probably it's the least manipulative movie he's done.
Right.
and I did love, for different reasons, Lost Highway. But I always feel like when I'm watching his movies that he clearly wanted me to be shocked, confused, perplexed.
Absurdity for the sake of absurdity.
Yeah, totally.
Right? Yeah. How do you feel about David Lynch, Paul?
I love his work, and I think most of his films, apart from The Straight Story, are cult films because you need to watch them again and again to try and work out the plot for yourself. And no matter how many times you watch Mulholland Drive or Lost Highway, etc., you always come up with different conclusions. You know,
so
I think that's what makes it fun because it can become interactive with who you watch the film with. And I suppose it's true. He probably does make films so that they are cult, you know? Even this TV show, Twin Peaks, you know?
Yeah.
That's as confusing as hell. You can keep watching that.
For no good reason, right?
I think David Cronenberg would be another one. Would you agree, Paul? Because, I mean, speaking of, I think of The Fly. I mean, all of his movies, actually. Mm. It's like he's intentionally setting out to be countercultural.
I want you guys to know that Eraserhead showed up all over Twitter.
Whoa. Did it.
So a lot of people knew it.
Well, now I feel like a fool.
They recognize the clip.
Well done.
Okay, to Peggy in St. Cloud. Hi, Peggy. You're back.
Hi.
Okay, hey.
About that.
That's okay. What's your cult classic?
Clockwork Orange.
Clockwork Orange.
Oh.
My husband knows this. I will not watch that movie. Too creepy and disturbing.
Because you've read the book.
No.
Oh, okay. Because
the book was
enough to go, okay, yeah.
No. Peggy, this is a movie that you watch over and over again?
No. Well, I mean, yes, I have watched it several times. I certainly don't, you know, watch it over and over obsessively, but it has so many layers to it. I think it has an artistic flavor to it, but it's also, you know, like that artistic player is coached in kind of societal ills and, you know, unresolved
I buy that
problem.
Maybe that's why it's so disturbing. Yeah.
It is. I agree. I think the artistic flair makes it disturbing, but it's just it's bringing those social ills to the surface and making us, you know, very naked and vulnerable.
Yeah.
And you really have to watch it over and over to catch all of the little innuendos and nuggets that you can apply to, you know, history of today.
Makes sense. Here's another dark cult classic. Joseph on Twitter says, funny games. It turns the suspense thriller genre on its head with a twist that's so left field, it blew my mind. Mm. To Mike in Excelsior. Yes. Hey, yes, Mike, hi.
Hi, how do you read me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Very good. Yeah, very interesting topic today. The first thing that came to my mind was Rollerball with James Caan, the original version. But then there's a couple other ones that made a big impact. One was Apocalypse Now. And then Eyes Wide Shut. And I get so fascinated by these things that, I know it's got to be something primal. Or, of course, with regard to James Caan, the original, I know that I was afflicted with machismo and testosterone at that point in my life, but it just did seem to me to be a very realistic outlook on what we were heading for. And I mean, you had Bloodsport, a lot of violence,
you're making the case here, Mike.
And I mean, motorcycles, pretty much the whole waterfront for me at that point in my life. But
Paul, what do you think of that explanation for Rollerball? It's popped up a couple times on Twitter too. Cult classic for you?
Yeah, for sure. But what I'm really fascinated by is someone bringing up the film Funny Games, because I was thinking we haven't really spoken about films out with America, really. And Michael Haneke, the director of Funny Games, has done so many left-field films and manipulates the audience a bit like David Lynch. One of his other films, Code Unknown, is a cult classic amongst like left-field art house fans. And I think Funny Games is just such a great example. It was remade in America. It wasn't as strong, but the original with Michael Haneke is a must-see.
Lily, how often do actors of color end up in cult classics? And do you think actors of color find it a riskier proposition to do films like that?
It's a great question, because I was thinking through this and thinking about people of color in the cult classic movies that I love, and it was very hard to find people of color. I mean, it was great that they mentioned Kinky Boots, because it's Chiwetel Ejiofor who played that role.
Right.
But overall, women as well. It was kind of hard to find an all-female cast or movies directed by women. They are out there.
Are there really all-female
casts? Well, I thought of Steel Magnolias, which is one that I think could actually qualify as a cult classic. It's one that I know I often quote. but then also, actually, particularly around my Black friends, The Color Purple is actually a movie that, even though it's quite serious and dramatic, is one that I've heard from so many people of color, but particularly the African-American community, that they quote, they watch
dialogue.
As families, they know the dialogue, they know the certain scenes. And yet that one, I don't know if it would technically qualify by the definitions we've been talking about.
But I like that we're widening the definition, because I tended to think that there always had to be an absurdist quality to a cult classic, and no.
Yeah, and I think the reflection of the lack of people of color in cult classics is just a reflection of the lack of people of color in movies,
period. Yeah. So I have another clip here to, this is Stump the Movie Critics here. Yeah. Paul, you ready for this too?
Yeah, go for it.
All right, here it comes.
Our trip was different. It was to be a classic affirmation of everything right and true in the national character. A gross physical salute to the fantastic possibilities of life in this country, but only for those with true grit. And we are chock full of that, man.
This one I know.
Lily's got it. What is it? Do you know, Paul?
I recognize. I'm still thinking.
Is it Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas?
Yeah.
I was like, that sounds like. Yep.
What gave it away for you? Because for a few seconds there, you were stumped.
I was stumped because, first of all, it doesn't sound like Johnny Depp. But then it was the kind of adventure when he quotes the kind of embarking on it. And I'm like, okay, Fear and Loathing. This is exactly it.
Is that the scene where they're where he's in the car driving
on the way? I think so.
And there's like this big vista behind him.
Yeah, that's a great example of a cult film too.
Is it? How? Why?
I feel like, particularly among men, I feel like they quote that movie often. Men who love to also read, oh my God, what's the very famous?
Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah. You know, they just love that movie. But I think also the same men who love Fight Club, they often are synonymous together with that movie.
Drenched with testosterone. Mm-hmm. Aaron says, how has no one mentioned The Big Lebowski? Aaron, we have.
We have.
Numerous times.
We can talk about it again, but I know you don't like it, Carrie.
Or any film by John Waters. I do want to talk about John Waters, where he fits in here.
Oh my God, you're so right. Pink Flamingos, Hairspray.
Right.
Yeah, Pink Flamingos, which is one that I wouldn't recommend necessarily watching. I'd love to hear what Paul thinks about that
Paul, one. John Waters, Pink Flamingos.
Seminole, that's like one of the top 10 ultimate cult classics. And I think with John Waters, in the early days, he just went out, made films in his own rules. Do you know what I mean? Not necessarily wanting to make a cult classic, but just wanted to make films starring his friends, being absurd, and just being completely different and out there. And like, he's done some amazing films such as Pecker, Crybaby, Serial Mom.
Serial Mom.
Good. Like, he's a cult classic director,
sure. Paul, this is interesting to hear you say this. I think I heard him on Fresh Air a year or so ago, and there was a part of the interview where he was talking about how he makes these movies really for himself, and that there was a time when he didn't expect that a lot of people would see the movies. So I think you've nailed it there. To Brenna in Excelsior. Hi, Brenna. Thanks for waiting.
Hi.
Sure. What's
you
the cult
guys
movie?
Have gone kind of dark and twisty with
I know.
David Lynch and movies, so I'm going to tell you my creepy David Lynch experience. A little old, sweet old lady I knew told me and my new husband we just absolutely had to see Blue Velvet. Winter of 88 or whatever, we rented it. And then we stayed up for 4 hours reading Winnie the Pooh every volume.
What were you on, Bretta? What were you smoking that night? You can come clean.
Nothing. We met her at a treatment program. It was the creepiest movie I ever saw. And I'm just like panicking now because you're reminding me of David Lynch crap.
Yeah,
I want to be friends with that little old lady.
I know. What's she all about? Serial killer living next door. Thanks, Bretta. Here's Tiki who says, Cool World is billed as a cult classic. I didn't like it, but would be interested in hearing your guests talk about it. Early Brad Pitt movie in which he's a detective in a cartoon world.
Well, and it was because the success of Roger Rabbit had kind of influenced this idea of you could have animation and then, you know, actors interacting with the animation. And that one was very, I actually would be fascinated to see it now. I haven't seen it in many years, but it was very sexual and avant-garde in a lot of ways. And it was, I believe it's Kim Basinger in this role that it was his love interest. And I don't know if Paul remembers it better, but I could see why that would be.
I wonder if that was about as experimental as Brad Pitt got. I mean, as I hear you describe this, I think that doesn't sound like a lot of the movies that he would make he became a real big star.
He did California and he did, I mean, I actually think he's gotten so much better as an actor, and I think he's gotten more adventurous too in picking certain roles. But there was a time period where he would be natural born killers. I mean, he would play these small roles and just really relish in doing that. And actually the Coen brothers, the name is completely gone from my mind, but it's the one where he plays like the guy who's really into working out. And do you remember this one?
He was in True Romance. Was he in True Romance as well? Or am I going
crazy? I'm sorry, no, it's True Romance, not Natural Born Killers. Yeah, he was in True Romance.
True Romance, playing like a Rastafarian.
Exactly,
or
and he's totally hamming it up, and he's so great in that.
Hey, Mommy Dearest has popped up on Twitter like many times. Paul, do you buy that as a cult classic? God, that is a creepy
100%.
Movie.
It is very
people
creepy.
Love that. People scream at it on the big screen. People quote the lines. It's funny. It's out there. It's wonderful acting. It's got some of the most well-known actors of all time. Yeah, 100%.
Jeff,
that's a good one.
Jeff says here, Swingers is to the young adult male what Dazed and Confused was to high schoolers. Timeless, but captures a moment in time. Yeah.
It definitely captures a moment in like that swing craze of the mid-90s with the Gap ads and everything. I think definitely for men. I mean, he's, you know, Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau capture that feeling of desperation very well. Yeah. I think maybe Paul can speak to this as a man more so
Paul,
than I can.
Yes, as a man, swingers.
I think now with Time Is Up and the Me Too movement, I think people view the film very differently.
No kidding.
Good point.
Yeah, great
good point.
Point.
You guys, this was really fun. Thanks so much. We'll do movies again at some point. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul.
Paul, thank you. Lily, thank you.
Time is fleeting. Madness takes its toll. But listen closely.
Not for very much longer.
I've got to keep control.
I remember doing the time warp, drinking those moments when the black pit would hit me and the boys would be calling.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.